Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, John Walker. John is a senior policy analyst at Fire Dog Lake. The website is firedoglake.com, and he is the author of the brand new book, After Legalization. And we'll find out legalization of what. John Walker, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So what's getting legalized, and how is it that you are so absolutely certain that it is going to get legalized?
Well, the book explores basically the future, or the likely future, for marijuana legalization in this country. And I sort of want to give people a real sense of how that would look like and how it would go about happening. And the real reason I think it's going to happen is if we look at sort of the polling and demographic data, we see there's just a huge trend in support towards legalization. Sports grown by about 28% over just the past decade, and it's really been driven by a generational change. You know, older senior citizens oppose it, but younger people overwhelmingly support it, and as sort of the natural demographic turnover continues, we're going to soon see a real change in the politics around the issue.
Which sounds like you're suggesting we have a good, healthy democracy and the democracy works, or at least that this is the type of issue on which it works. Because I can think of things where we've had public opinion one way for quite some time, such as sharing a little bit of money with the other 99% of us and the government not going along.
Yeah, this issue is sort of uniquely good at being moved through with the ballot initiative process. I mean, a lot of the issues, there's overwhelming support, but there tends to be sort of big money opposition. There is some big money opposition to marijuana legalization, but it's nothing compared to, say, you know, raising taxes on the wealthy or like single-payer health care. So we've already seen legalization start making some big strides in just the past few years. Colorado and Washington both legalized it by ballot initiatives. Next year, probably should have an initiative in Alaska and Oregon. And in 2016, it looks like probably California, Nevada, Maine, Massachusetts, you know, a few other states. And that will be probably a really big wave election for marijuana legalization on the ballot.
So what specifically is legal now in Colorado and Washington?
It's legal, but it's highly, highly restricted. So if you're over 21, under state law in both those states, you can have up to an ounce of marijuana. And very soon, the retail shops will open where you can purchase marijuana from. So they've created a license system for legal growers and legal retail stores to both produce it and sell it to the customers. And as long as you sort of smoke it in a private place, you know, you can't consume it publicly. There's a really tight restrictions on what you can do with that legal marijuana. But it is now legal to purchase, you know, up to an ounce of marijuana, take it home and enjoy it as an adult.
One other place that's been in the news, Uruguay. What exactly has happened there?
Oh, yeah. So they passed a law very similar to what Colorado and Washington did. It's legal, but very tightly restricted. So in Uruguay, if you're a resident of Uruguay, they don't want any sort of pot tourism coming in. So you can't buy it if you're not a resident. But if you're a resident of Uruguay, you can buy up to 40 grams a month from pharmacies that will be licensed and distributing marijuana regulated by the government. Or you can grow a limited amount at home or join a sort of cannabis club like they have in Spain. So again, you know, it's legal, but highly restricted and sort of highly limited. The whole point was to take the money out of the underground, you know, and out of the black market and away from criminals and put it in the hands of the government.
Interesting. Your book, After Legalization, it's fantastic in how it's done because you intentionally haven't written how you think marijuana would best be legalized, but how you predict it might be. And so you paint a picture of what things look like, I think, in the year 2030. Why did you decide to do it that way? Why not present to us exactly how best you think it ought to be done?
Yeah, so my big thinking about this is if you really want to affect policy and you really want to get involved in policy, you really should have a great idea of where things are going and sort of what the relevant political fights are going to be. You know, who are the different sort of sides of the issue going to be? What are the political dynamics at stake? And I want to give people that because that would allow them the basis of deciding how they want marijuana to look like. You know, there's a lot of people out there who have a lot of different ideas of what, you know, legal marijuana should look like. And that ranges everything from, you know, sort of no restrictions, as easy to buy as French fries at a fast food place, to very tightly restricted like they do alcohol in, you know, North Carolina, which is a controlled state. and the government has an entire monopoly on all hard liquor sales. So I wanted to give people a sense of how it would likely turn out, like what's the current sort of glide path it's on, to give people a real idea of, if that's not what they want, how they should get involved. Like, what are the, you know, there's all sorts of tiny little issues that people don't tend to think about, and those tend to have, you know, the hugest impact on what sort of the culture and the industry is going to turn out like.
The book is very well researched and fascinating in how important regulations have been at the local and state and federal levels on other things like alcohol, how regulations created the spread of microbreweries, which I had no idea about, and so forth. Your expectation, I take it from the book, is for there to be a wide variety of different types of partial legalization in cities and towns and states across the country.
Yeah, so I've really looked at the history of alcohol, especially right after the 21st Amendment was repealed, and it was a very sort of localized issue. And I think that's very much what we're seeing with marijuana. And if you look at the polling, that's what the people want with marijuana. There's like a CBS poll that found, like, I think 65% of Americans want marijuana's legal status to be decided by the state. And interestingly enough, that is bipartisan support for that. Basically, as many Republicans as Democrats want treated that way. You know, Democrats want to see marijuana legalized. Republicans support state rights. And so I would definitely see that is sort of the union point on this issue. And so we're going to probably see to a large degree a repeat of what happened with alcohol regulation. And, you know, alcohol regulation in this country is weird, bizarre, and fascinating. You know, there's still parts of Mississippi that their prohibition is still in place. You know, the state only ended prohibition in 66 and left it up to the counties to decide if they wanted to end it. And still half the state is basically completely dry. You can't even brew beer at home legally in much of Mississippi.
When I was a teenager in Virginia, there was a period of time there when people would drive to either Washington, D.C. or West Virginia to get alcohol, where the age was younger than the age in Virginia. Are we going to see people traveling across state lines and across city and county lines to find more accessible marijuana?
Oh, yeah, you know, we see that with alcohol. You know, we even see that with tobacco, you know, in certain states or certain cities with a higher alcohol, tobacco tax, you'll often see people from, say, New York driving to, you know, New Jersey or Connecticut to buy their cigarettes. You know, we're already going to start seeing that in January. You know, the first Colorado shops open in Colorado, and then in March, roughly, they should start opening in Washington. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see some people from Oregon, you know, driving across the border buying some marijuana. That's almost guaranteed to happen. There's almost no way to stop that.
What will typical or different types of marijuana stores look like?
Yeah, this is all basically how each individual, both state and city, decides to have them look like. But I suspect, at least looking at the model of what's happening in Colorado and Washington, the rules are it has to be basically a strictly marijuana store. You know, you can't be selling marijuana at a grocery store or a liquor store or a corner market. You have to basically be a store that specializes only in marijuana-related products. In a lot of places, that's how hard liquor is sold in this country. You know, there's a half dozen states where the only place to buy hard liquor is the state-run stores, and there's a lot of other states where the only place you can sell hard liquor is in a special liquor store, private liquor store. That will very likely be the trend with marijuana. You know, it will be a special marijuana store. Only people over 21 will be able to enter. Only thing you'll be able to buy there is basically marijuana.
So there won't be marijuana at the grocery store or at the Walmart?
No. Well, you know, maybe some 30, 40 years down the road, they'll start loosening up the rules. But in the short term, you know, if you look at polling, they want marijuana legal, but they want it tightly controlled and restricted. And that's, you know, the current path we're on.
What about the Walmartization of the marijuana, either growers or distributors, with just about anything else, including groceries, including beer? You get to, you know, it looks like there's endless brands and varieties, but there's three or four companies that own them all. Why wouldn't marijuana go the same way, or might it?
Well, yeah, this is one of those big questions of, or, you know, one of those questions that people don't tend to think about very much, but this is where regulation is incredibly important. I know in Washington State, they're really concerned about quote-unquote big marijuana, or like a Starbucks of weed. So in Washington State, they have a limit of only 3 licenses per, you know, business or conglomerate or owner. So they're put a hard cap on how many you know, individual farms or retail shops a single company can own, because they want to keep the field small and diverse. And, you know, if you make that decision, and if we make that decision, we can keep it diverse. You know, if we go with different regulations that are unfriendly to small business, which was very much the regulations covering beer for a long time in this country, you'll end up with a concentrated market. You know, we had in the 70s only about 60 breweries in the entire country. But once they changed the regulations, you know, allowed you to open brew pubs in the 80s, we finally allowed home brewing so people could sort of experiment, you know, come up with a recipe before trying to launch a brewery. You've had a huge explosion in diversity. I think we're over 3,000 breweries in the country at this point.
The book is called After Legalization, and the author is John Walker, who is also a senior policy analyst at FireDogLake.com. John, your prediction in the book is that marijuana will become dramatically less expensive, and yet dramatically more expensive than it could be. That is, it will be heavily taxed. How do you come to that conclusion?
Well, so we, you know, I'm looking both at the history of alcohol and tobacco regulation and also what's happened in Colorado and Washington. In Washington, they've adopted a 25% tax. So the grower pays a 25%, or when the grower sells it to the wholesaler, a 25% excise tax is paid. And when the wholesaler pays it to the retailer, 25% excise tax is paid. So that works out to basically a 55% tax on marijuana in Washington. I mean, Colorado, they have a 15% tax retail, 15% retail tax and a 10% sales tax. So, and then the, you know, regular sales taxes as well. So both those states have adopted very high marijuana taxes, and I think we'll likely see the same thing. You know, the current trend with tobacco taxes is constantly going up. You know, when politicians need to raise money for something, one of the first places they go to is a tobacco tax, because not that many people smoke it. And, you know, targeting thin taxes is politically easy. I think Obama just recently, you know, just was it last year, suggested universal pre-K, and his payment was going to be like a dollar increase in the tobacco tax. So marijuana falls into a sort of similar place in people's minds. You know, it's kind of a sin. Most people don't smoke marijuana. That's an easy way to sort of raise tax revenue off of someone else. I wouldn't be surprised if we started seeing taxes very similar to the taxes on tobacco. Which is, you know, there's some countries where, you know, 70% of the price of a pack of cigarettes in, like, Finland or something is just all from tax.
It does seem more likely than going short one aircraft carrier or something of that nature. That explains the high price, but you also predict that marijuana will be nonetheless much, much cheaper than it is now. This may be obvious, but what accounts for that?
Oh, yeah. You know, anytime you're running an illegal business, you have all these sort of costs that a regular business doesn't have to deal with. You can't, like, advertise, hey, I need someone to run my, you know, illegal business operation on LinkedIn. You know, finding people is more difficult. Banking's more difficult. You know, currently even the medical marijuana dispensaries, which are legal under state law, the federal government still considers them illegal under federal law. So it doesn't allow any of the banks to accept accounts from them. So all these dispensaries are running as these sort of weird cash-only operations. You know, that makes it more difficult to order equipment, pay bills. You know, every step of running a business just becomes that much more difficult. Things are illegal. You know, you run the risk of being arrested. You run the risk of having, you know, all your products seized. Once those risks are gone, I wouldn't be surprised to see the price of marijuana drop down to very much what we see for other similar products like gum. You know, I think a close example might be something like white tea or, you know, high-end cigars, you know, which is sort of a similar agricultural product that needs a lot of sort of hand, you know, production. And those tend to sell only about, like, you know, $10 an ounce, which is, you know, one-tenth, you know, one-twentieth the price of what marijuana is currently selling for on the black market.
If that, if the criminality of the business goes away, do we also empty out our prisons? Do we give amnesty to those sentenced for marijuana crimes prior to legalization? And if so, what do we do about the pressures from the for-profit prison industry? Will they have to invent some other crime with which to fill those beds if marijuana is legal now?
Yeah, you know, this is always one of the places we're going to get pushback from. the for-profit prisons and the drug testing industry is actually a big money maker, you know.
Yeah.
All these companies do drug testing. The only drug you can really test for is marijuana. You know, almost every other drug set up your system within a day or something. So, you know, it's all about finding marijuana use to a large degree. You know, there'll obviously be pushback on it. I think sort of the politics of it have started to change, you know. The cost of our prison system is getting so expensive that you're even seeing a lot of Republicans starting to seriously talk about this issue. Like, Rand Paul's been pretty good on drug prison reform lately. So, you know, you'll always be fighting these powerful interests, but I think this is one issue. Marijuana accounts for a decent number of prisoners, but it's not nearly as big of a driver as a sort of hard drug.
So, really? You know, I thought it was a big... I thought it was a big contributor to our to the number of people in prison. Not so?
Well, it's a big contributor to the number of people arrested. When we're talking about federal prisons, that tends to be a lot of sort of hard drug crime. Less marijuana. The state level is where you tend to see more of the marijuana people in prison. And what really drives, actually, the numbers is not so much people in there specifically for marijuana, but it's a common parole violation.
Right.
You know, so you're arrested for something else. You're caught with some marijuana, you know, you test positive for some marijuana, you get back in prison. You wouldn't technically be in prison for marijuana at that point, but marijuana is what put you back in prison.
The much-hyped mythical fear of marijuana as a gateway to other drugs is something you suggest in the book actually has some reality as long as marijuana is criminal, but not in the way that people imagine. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, if the idea is people are using drugs and that leads them to other drugs, then the real gate would be alcohol, because that's the first drug, you know, most people use. The only way marijuana has really ever been a gateway drug, quote-unquote, is that, you know, criminals don't care about the law. You know, they're inherently criminals. So if you go to buy marijuana, there's a good chance that, you know, your dealer may offer you other hard drugs. If you look at the statistics from Europe, the place where you're least likely to be offered hard drugs when you buy marijuana is the Netherlands. The only place it's de facto legal. You know, only about 9% of people who buy marijuana from, you know, the coffee shop say they've been offered hard drugs when they bought marijuana. If you look at other countries, you know, it's, you know, well over like 20% will say that they were offered hard drugs when they went to buy marijuana. And that really shows you that the Netherlands did a great job of separating the marijuana business from sort of the other, you know, the cocaine and the heroin business. And it has done a good job of preventing the sort of gateway effect that's caused when you push everything into the black market.
Would you expect there to be cafes like in the Netherlands in the United States, or would people smoke marijuana or use marijuana in whatever form in their homes? You seem to think public spaces would remain free of marijuana to the extent they are right now.
Yeah, you know, and we have a lot of, you know, anti-public drinking laws in this country, and we've developed a lot of anti-public smoking tobacco laws. You know, I imagine a very similar thing would apply for marijuana. If you look at Colorado and Washington State, their laws specifically ban, or their regulations specifically ban what's known as on-premise consumption. You can't buy marijuana at a place and then smoke it there. And this is a long tradition in alcohol regulation. Kansas only ended prohibition in 48, but they forever prohibited, quote-unquote, open saloons until they changed the Constitution in 78. So for 30 years, you know, bars were illegal in Kansas City. Now, Kansas State. People get around this by having, quote-unquote, private clubs where you'd sort of pay a membership due that would kind of work like a bar that wasn't legally a bar. You know, we're already seeing that reemerge in Washington State. You know, someone's tried to open a private smoke lounge. You pay $10 to go in there to smoke, and they claim that's a private space, not a public space, so they can do that. And, you know, we'll see that kind of thing happen. You know, the Elks Clubs, a lot of these fraternal orders, were originally created to get around sort of these public bar laws that used to be passed after Prohibition ended.
The other prediction that you make that I think is probably right, but for a lot of people, I think, counterintuitive, just like the prediction that if you guaranteed people an income, people would still work, which I think is right. You suggest that if marijuana is legal, the number of people regularly using it would still be about exactly what it is now.
Yeah, you know, if we look at other countries, like we look at the Netherlands, where it's effectively been legal for, you know, several decades now, their use rates are much lower than the United States. And if we look at, you know, countries which have either made their marijuana laws tougher or made them a lot more lenient, there doesn't tend to be much change in the amount of people who are smoking marijuana. You know, we have not seen sort of a big explosion in marijuana use in places where the medical marijuana laws really lack. This whole idea that legality is the thing stopping people from doing things is, you know, it just doesn't make sense. You know, skydiving is legal, but very few people do it because they don't want to go skydiving. And, you know, if marijuana was legal, we'd still have a lot of people who just don't enjoy it or, you know, have some religious objection to it or, you know, just don't want to take part, and they will continue not to take part.
I don't go skydiving because it's expensive. If you were buying, I'd be going skydiving every day. I think. I've never tried it. The question, I guess, coming back to the certainty that you have that this is going to go in this direction in one way or another, is why has the propaganda failed? Why, you know, has the harassment of those trying to legalize marijuana failed? Why has the IRS intimidation? Why has all the pressure of the government and the corporate media failed, or is it in the process of failing on this issue?
Well, I think it's really failing to a large degree because people, more and more Americans, have had direct experience with marijuana. And there's a fascinating statistic. I think it was in, like, 69, about 5% of college students said they had tried marijuana. And then, starting in about, like, 74, you know, like, half of college students said they had tried marijuana. And so, you know, there used to be a generation, but no direct experience with it, none of their friends used it, blah, blah. They were more than prepared to accept this sort of weird, you know, insane propaganda we used to see. You know, marijuana was supporting terrorists, marijuana, you know, would turn you crazy type of thing.
But didn't young people see that stuff before they tried it, and yet they went ahead and tried it?
Yeah, they did. But, you know, they also had that sort of direct experience of, you know, peers and, you know, other people they knew who had tried it.
Yeah.
And sort of the change in experience has really made the propaganda less effective, I feel. That, you know, it's easy to scare people about something they have no knowledge of. But, you know, if you're seeing all these scary claims about marijuana, yet you know all these kids in your school are smoking marijuana, you got to think that, you know, there's some disconnect. There's something wrong with that.
So the successfully propagandized population is aging out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, to a large degree, you know, both on whether you support marijuana legalization or not, you know, there's a real sort of cliff around maybe the age of, like, 68 right now. You know, if you're over that age, you probably don't support it. If you're under that, you probably do.
Is the internet as a way to communicate facts and reasonable opinions making a really a significant difference that you can document on this?
Yeah, I think you know this is a great issue for the internet because for a long time it was very sort of ignored or made fun of in the media, and the internet has really exposed that there's a real hunger for this issue. You know. Every time Obama tried to do some kind of online town hall or something, the dominant questions were always about drug policy or marijuana. You know, up to the point where they basically had to stop letting people vote on questions to submit because it was always marijuana. You know, the first, you know, petition on his petition site was for marijuana legalization.
Right.
You know, his YouTube town hall, 180 of the 200 top questions were all, you know, marijuana or drug policy. I think the internet has, one, allowed people to sort of spread information without having to go through this sort of top-down approach where, you know, media would always get, like, both sides, you know, maybe talk to someone who's pro-marijuana and then follow it up with some insane propaganda from, you know, someone from the drugstore's office. So I think, you know, the explosion in sort of just marijuana-related news sites online and the ability to sort of break through the narrative that, you know, this is sort of some comical fringe issue. No, this is something people really care about. This is something that really moves people. You know, I think politicians are really finally taking notice because they see how powerful it's been online.
So people who care about how this goes, who get the book after legalization and read it and see the incredible variety of possibilities for how states and localities might legalize and partially legalize and permit the use of marijuana, once they are thus informed, what should people do? How can people get active? How can people push to have regulations nationally and in their locality go in a desirable way?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things you can get involved early when your state is perhaps pushing for a marijuana legalization initiative. You can contact your member, your local representatives, tell them that not only that you support marijuana legalization, but these are the issues in it that you care about. And especially when your state, after your state sort of legalized marijuana, like what we're seeing in Washington, Colorado right now, where the rules were being written, there's comment periods. And, we have seen some impact on sort of comment from people who are concerned. Like in Washington State, the Liquor Control Board originally suggested ending home growing for medical marijuana patients. They received a lot of pushback, an outcry from the community, and they reversed that recommendation. And so getting involved, people don't tend to get involved in those things, but if that's what you care about, those are sort of real points of leverage. It's not just the legalization law passed, everything's good, sunshine and roses. Get involved, pay attention to the rules being written, make a public comment, contact these boards or the rules writing committee. That will have a real impact.
You make the case very well, I think, in the book for the incredibly powerful, if not very sexy, force of inertia. How much easier is it for people to get these regulations right early than to come back a few years later and redo it?
Yeah, my go-to example is the Electoral College, which is incredibly stupid, unfair, and very unpopular. Yet we still have it 200 years later because, once it's in place, there's, weird states and political parties that benefit from it. The effort to change it is monumental. That will very much, we see that with healthcare too. It was a lot easier when countries were putting it in place, single-payer systems right after World War II in Europe. When they're sort of rebuilding from scratch. Now trying to reform our healthcare system has become hugely difficult with all the money interests at play. As the industry's gotten bigger and bigger and more corrupt. And so getting things right to begin with is so critically important because when they haven't started yet, it's still sort of an open marketplace of ideas. Once they get started, then you've got people who, even if the system's broken, are making lots of money off of it being broken. They're going to fight tooth and nail to keep it broken in the way that helps them.
Excellent advice from the author of a wonderful new book that I highly recommend, whether you care about marijuana or not. You will be fascinated by the issues that are brought out. The book is called After Legalization. The author is John Walker. John, thanks very, very much for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.